This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Fed Access with Derek T. Dortch on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Derek walks you through how to win government jobs and contracts, effectively manage your government career, and best utilize government services. Every week on Fed Access, you'll learn about interesting federal agencies, workers, and jobs. Fed Access provides you the access you need to succeed in the federal government. And now your host, Derek T. Dortch.
Welcome to Fed Access with Derek T. Dortch on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Thank you for stopping by the show. We're going to have a really, really great show where we're going to talk about foreign affairs today. We're talking about what's happening at State Department and other agencies. I have on the line Daniel Hirsch. Daniel, are you the vice president of AFSA State Department side, right? Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay.
I'm the state vice president of AFSA. AFSA represents five foreign affairs agencies. USAID, Foreign Commercial Service, Foreign Agricultural Service, the State Department, obviously, and the Broadcasting Board of Governors, each of which has its own vice president. So I am the State Department vice president.
Outstanding. Daniel just broke that down. AFSA is the American Foreign Service Association, and he's on the line today to talk to us about what AFSA is and then what issues are being dealt with at State Department, not only issues about representing the U.S. around the world, but also what issues are State Department employees concerned about as AFSA represents them. Daniel, you know, we were just talking about, AFSA and talking about the organization. You guys are unique, where there's sometimes people are an association and then sometimes they're just federal unions, but you guys are both. Give me the breakdown of what you guys do.
Okay. AFSA is indeed unique among federal bargaining units in that we are a professional association as well as the sole bargaining unit for the five foreign affairs agencies that we represent. As a professional association, we look at the various professions that are represented in the Foreign Service and look at developing those professions both with an eye towards, increasing the professionalism and standards within those professions, as well as looking at the future development of the skills that those professions will need as America moves forward into the century. We also represent the Foreign Service to the American people, to the media, to various educational institutions, and of course to Congress. As a bargaining unit, we represent some 14,000 active duty members of these various agencies, we represent them in a full range of terms of employment type of issues.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
Basically, we cannot negotiate salaries. No federal union can negotiate salaries. But pretty much any term of employment that is within the discretionary authority of the Secretary of State or any of the secretaries of our agencies must be negotiated with us. So we negotiate a very broad range of issues, including due process, fair compensation, security issues, issues related to service overseas. Of course, we serve the bulk of our careers overseas.
Right.
As well as we also work with Congress to support issues with Congress, such as family leave for the Foreign Service, such as overseas comparability pay, which AFSA was extremely successful in basically originating for the Foreign Service, which brings Foreign Service careers into line with other federal salaries that are affected by locality pay or federal pay comparability under the Federal Pay Comparability Act.
You know, as an association and a union, in terms of your membership, and I know you kind of cover all the different other like USAID and Voice of America and the people and the International Broadcast Bureau and everybody else. With all of that, your membership consists of is it everybody who's an active Foreign Service officer? Can you be a civil? I mean, break your membership down.
Yeah, our membership includes active duty Foreign Service mm-hmm. members. It includes retired Foreign Service members.
Okay.
And it includes some associate members who are usually either academics or people on the Hill or. In some cases, they are aspiring Foreign Service members. In mm-hmm. other words, it's not unusual for somebody who thinks they want to enter the Foreign Service at some near future point to become an associate member of AFSA.
Okay, okay. With all of that, in terms of, you know, your membership and everywhere else, are we talking about, you know, when a person does get this membership, if somebody was aspiring or somebody is a Foreign Service officer, whatever the case is, and do they have to be a Foreign Service officer to be an active, or can they be a civil servant working for State Department and still get a full membership, or do they have to be an associate member?
Well, You could be a civil service employee and be an associate member of AFSA.
Okay, I got you.
You cannot be a civil service employee and be an active member of AFSA. Although, civil service employees of the State Department are represented by other groups such as AFGI.
Okay. Okay. So you guys are unique in which you represent the unique category of Foreign Service officers, people who have been given that category within the U.S. government.
That's correct. We represent all Foreign Service members. I want to be clear that the Foreign Service actually includes both Foreign Service officers and a wide range of specialists,
mm-hmm.
Including almost 30 different categories of specialist groups.
Okay.
So we actually in AFSA refer to Foreign Service members rather than Foreign Service officers.
Okay.
Because a significant portion of our membership is, in fact, not FSOs.
And so the Foreign Service Specialists, they may be people who are not FSOs, but they still have served overseas. They still have that designation in something like that.
That's correct. They're still members of the Foreign Service. They do serve overseas. They include people like security officers. They
mm-hmm.
include people like information management specialists. They include various technical skill groups. As I said, almost 30 different categories of specialists.
Right, right, right. In terms of AFSA, when we look at it and look at kind of maybe your reach within the agencies and kind of helping, you know, Foreign Service officer, Foreign Service members in terms of different issues, I mean, I've always noticed that you have a number of different kind of committees and a number of different things, like on your website, like even under your area, you have different committees where the advisory committees, where overseas family members or everything from GLBT issues to gay and lesbian and bisexual, you know, transgender issues, issues that deal with due processing. So you guys cover a lot of different issues.
Oh, we cover a huge range of issues. There are basically three or four different categories of things that we deal with. So one of them is dealing with Congress. Another is dealing with big picture issues. With the agency, for example, things like the implementation of QDDR or the big picture views of security overseas, which, of course, is very much in the public eye right now. But then we also have a lot of and some of them are both big picture and small picture mm-hmm. issues. We have a lot of cases, issues that are individual casework that involve individuals. We also have a lot of situations in which the individual casework involving individuals points to some larger big picture issue within the organization. But
okay.
Basically, due process issues, issues related to discipline, issues related to security clearance reviews, ensuring fairness in assignments. And then, as you mentioned, there's a whole suite of issues related to the fact that the Foreign Service spends the bulk of its careers overseas.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Since we live overseas, there is a whole suite of issues related to caring for our families overseas,
yeah.
ensuring the security of our families overseas,
right.
What kind of housing, what kind of educational allowances, what kind of health protections do we have,
I was even reading so on your page that, and I think maybe these are some of the columns that either you have written or maybe other members have written, but you've got columns that, you know, dealing with divorce and dealing with, you know, I mean,
that's
people
right.
who
I
have
mean,
to go
all
overseas.
These things, indeed. The articles on my page are the ones that I have written myself mm-hmm. As in my role as the vice president. But indeed, for example, just you look at something as ordinary or everyday, perhaps, as divorce,
mm-hmm.
It can be hugely complicated when you are serving your country overseas, when the government actually is in physical possession of your property, when, you know, one of the partners in a divorce or one of the parties in a divorce is a government employee and the other will soon be leaving the realm in which the government cares about that person. You know, simple things that in the U.S. might be much easier to deal with
right.
Can be magnified by
very,
service
very,
overseas.
Very complicated when you're in Pakistan or some other kind
exactly.
of a unique region and you have to deal with these issues. You know, Daniel, I want to take a quick break. When we come back, we've got a number of different things to talk about because you mentioned a number of things you kind of represent the Foreign Service members about, everything from the QDDR to the federal pay freeze to, you know, issues, security issues and everything else. I want to get into these issues that you guys are really on the forefront of handling and trying to address when we come back. We're talking to Daniel Hirsch. He is representing the American Foreign Service Association, and he is the vice president, and he represents Department of State. He's a State Department Foreign Service member, Foreign Service officer, and he represents all the different issues for State Department employees. But the AFSA, the American Foreign Service Association, is a professional association and union that represents all the Foreign Service members in a number of different issues. We'll be talking about that and much, much more when we come back. You listen to Fed Access with Derek T. Dortch on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Welcome back to Fed Access with Derek T. Dortch on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. If you just joined us, we are talking about the American Foreign Service Association. They're an association that represents a number of different agencies, including the State Department, USAID, the Broadcasting Board of Governors, the U.S. Commercial Service, the USDA Foreign Agriculture Service, and I also they represent part of USDA, which is the Agricultural Plant Inspection Service. And they represent a number of different members who are foreign service officers and foreign service specialists in our U.S. government working overseas to represent us and deal with their issues, everything from dealing with due process to fairness to pay issues to security issues and everything else. I've got on the line with me Daniel Hirsch. He's a vice president and he represents the State Department side of the American Foreign Service Association. And we're talking about the issues at state right now. Daniel, you got a new secretary right now, Secretary Kerry. And then I also was reading through your QDDR, your quadrennial review that you guys got going on over there. What thoughts about, I mean, I know he's new and everything else, and so we probably can't talk about it too much. Thoughts about Secretary Kerry as Secretary Clinton has gone forward. But then about the quadrennial diplomacy and development review, what's your thoughts on that in terms of pushing that? How has it been, you know, going in terms of implementation? Do you feel good about the document? You feel things need to change? What's going on with that?
Well, first, let me say that we have very high hopes for Secretary Kerry. He has a tough act to follow. Secretary Clinton was outstanding in her foreign policy role and was a very strong defender of the Foreign Service on the Hill. Secretary Kerry, as I said, has a tough act to follow. But he has gotten off to a very strong start. He has his own Foreign Service family background. He was a strong supporter of the Foreign Service as a senator. He has indicated in his first couple of weeks in service a very strong support for the Foreign Service, and as I said, we have very high hopes. The QDDR was an initiative of Secretary Clinton's, and basically, it is a quadrennial review of diplomacy and development. And the idea behind the QDDR is a good idea, which is every 4 years to look at our diplomatic functions and to look at our roles in international development to make sure that we are actually on track to achieve the goals that we would like to achieve, and that there is some sort of common coordination of these two very important roles that our government plays in foreign relations. Both diplomacy and international development promote good relations not only between the United States and other countries, but also in general create a better world, in a sense. They create a more prosperous world that is less likely to be involved in conflicts, and particularly to be involved, of course, in conflicts with the United States.
Right.
So the goal of the QDDR is to coordinate those functions. Now, when it comes down to the details, when it comes down to who will do what and how, that often touches then on the individuals involved, on the skill sets that are involved, on, you know, which agency will be responsible for which function. And those are areas that AFSA becomes involved in discussing with the agencies to make sure, A, that the professionals who are involved in these tasks are appropriately trained and that they have the career paths that they were expecting, and basically that A, they are given tasks that they are skilled at doing, and B, that they are then given the tools they need to do the jobs that are asked of them.
You know, as it seems as if, and I know Under Secretary Clinton, it seems as if the mission of State Department and maybe USAID and others, you guys are increasingly getting more put on you. I mean, it seems as if the mission of the work overseas and diplomacy and statecraft and international development and working on whether it be counterterrorism issues or energy issues are growing. Even as I look through the QDDR, just the number of new dynamics of the Bureau of Counterterrorism. I mean, certain things that you guys have, you know, have now come into fruition, but even the Undersecretary of Economic Growth and Energy and, you know, Bureau for Energy Resources, all creating these new bureaus and other kind of dynamics because the world seems to be changing. Do you see within the State Department and in the issues you represent, do you see that this will be a continued growth for State Department? Or, and this kind of goes into the budget dynamics as we're with this, you know, situation where budgets are getting tighter and tighter, is more being asked of you guys to do more, but with less resources?
Well, let me say first that indeed the issue of resources has been a problem with our agencies for a long, long time.
Okay.
One of the things that is happening now is that our work, which had been less visible for a while, is now much more visible. But that doesn't necessarily mean that it's more important now, as it was always important, and it was always a lot of work, but right now it is more visible. Now, that said, there are indeed some new categories and new aspects of our work that are the result, indeed, of changes in the world. I mean, the threat from terrorism, as you mentioned, has grown substantially over the last several years. There are new technologies for communications, social media, those sorts of things, which are playing an increasing role in relationships between peoples and countries, and also can be used as tools to tell the American story. There are changes in the way business is done all over the world, with the increasing power, or if you will, of multinational corporations, the increasing prevalence of business being done that involves many different countries in the creation of a single product or in the sale of a single product. All of those aspects do add new dimensions to our work.
Mm-hmm.
Do you feel
even with the, and I agree, the resources have always been an issue. Do you feel that you are getting what you need, or is that something that you're also fighting for as the association, as AFSA is doing? Are you guys saying, hey, listen, I mean, you're asking us to do these things. You're asking us to put more and more in terms of the international business markets, in terms of energy, in terms of terrorism and everything else. Is that something that you guys are continuously pushing for?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Okay.
And we're also, on the one hand, the State Department has historically been underfunded for years.
Okay.
On another hand, we have been specifically underfunded in relation to security. For example, the Inman Commission recommended improvements to American embassies overseas, and a significant percentage of American embassies still, a couple of decades later, don't meet those standards because, simply put, the money has not been there to perform those upgrades.
The crazy thing about this is, Daniel, that, you know, we've got these commissions and everybody's harping on this Benghazi situation, and you're seeing these congressional hearings and everything else, and they keep on talking about what happened in Benghazi. But then on the other side, then you're saying, you know, as Congress is saying, well, what happened? Why didn't you do this, or why didn't this happen? But then you guys are saying, you know, security has been an issue for many, many years. It almost seems to be a disconnect between Congress and what the real reality is in the State Department.
Well, you know, part of the problem is that security, the thing about security is, if you successfully prevent a terrorist attack, nobody knows about it.
Right, right.
So if you are successful in preventing, you know, 300 terrorist attacks, it looks like you're not doing anything because nothing is making it into the newspapers. Nobody has been hurt. You can't even really prove in some cases that you prevented an attack.
Right.
The other thing is that the enemy, global terrorism, these terrorist organizations are global, and they have people all over the world looking for the soft spots. So you can beef up security at one embassy, and they will know, you know, this embassy is secure, so they'll look for another embassy.
Mm-hmm.
And they're constantly looking for the place that has not been hardened the way some other place might have been. So the part of the problem is that when you are doing things correctly, you don't have a product to show Congress. In other words, simply saying people are safe is not something that, again, that you can document very well.
Right.
And Congress likes people to be accountable for their money.
Mm-hmm.
So that's if that makes sense, that's one sort of internal contradiction in funding. But indeed, some of these things are extremely expensive. I mean, it costs millions of dollars to harden an embassy appropriately.
And
even if Congress gives the department millions of dollars, they are not enough millions of dollars to harden all of the embassies that need hardening.
Hold that thought real quick, Daniel. We need to take a quick break. When we come back, I want to keep on talking about security. Then I also want to talk about, you know, you guys pay. There's a lot of sacrifice that goes in the Foreign Service. I don't think necessarily people even know, and you can probably speak to it.
Oh, absolutely.
In terms of some of the hardships and everything else. Let's talk about that. Let's talk about the pay and other issues that Foreign Service members are dealing with. We're talking about the Foreign Service. We're talking about the American Foreign Service Association. They're a professional association, a union that represents the different members who are Foreign Service members, Foreign Service officers, and Foreign Service specialists of a number of different agencies, including State Department, USAID, the Foreign Commercial Service, and a few others. We're talking about that with Daniel Hirsch. He's the vice president who focuses in on the Department of State. That's his area. He's a State Department employee, but he represents State Department employees at the American Foreign Service Association. We'll keep on talking about these issues, about Foreign Service members and what the issues they're dealing with as they conduct their hard jobs overseas. We'll talk about that when we come back. You listen to Fed Access with Derek T. Deutsch on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Welcome back to Fed Access with Derek T. Dortch on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. If you're just joining us, we're talking about foreign service issues. We're talking about that with the American Foreign Service Association with Daniel Hirsch. He is a vice president representing the Department of State at the American Foreign Service Association. American Foreign Service Association is a unique association because it's not only a professional association, but it's also a union representing the foreign service members, foreign service officers, and foreign service specialists for a number of different agencies. Daniel, we were talking about security issues, which has definitely been on the mind of everybody since the Benghazi situation. But the truth of it is, as we look back, there's been a number of different attacks at different embassies. I used to be in the Marine Corps, and I remember, a number of different situations that dealt with embassies across the board. Never really got a lot of play or not a news attention or anything else. So people didn't really hear about anything until Benghazi. So they didn't really know about what the hardship and what the security environment sometimes is for foreign service members. I mean, talk about that a little bit more. What are foreign service members really facing when they go into some of these environments?
Well, of course, I think many people have also seen the movie Argo now.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that we face is simply due to the fact that American diplomats represent the United States to the world. And when we are in a foreign country and when we are working in an American embassy, anybody who has a gripe to pick with the United States makes us their target.
Mm-hmm.
So diplomats from all countries have historically been targets for anybody who wanted to attack their country, and American diplomats regularly have been targeted by terrorists and other people who are not fond of the United States. That has led to a variety of things, ranging from, the more dramatic events such as Benghazi or the bombings of our embassies in Nairobi and in Tanzania, but also to many, many smaller attacks, ranging from people shooting at diplomats to people attempting to kidnap diplomats to people setting off small explosives in front of American embassies that thank God, do not kill anybody. Mm-hmm. I myself, in my own career, have been targeted by Osama bin Laden's organization before 9/11,
mm-hmm.
When the consulate in which I was working at the time was being targeted. And most of my colleagues who have been in for a long time, have similar stories to tell. So number one, we are frequently the primary targets of terrorist attacks long before 9/11. And number two, in many cases, we also face just some very high crime threats in places around the world that have higher cases of violent crime than the United States, for example, South Africa.
Let me interject real quick, because a lot of times people are thinking that the majority of you guys are foreign service members are living kind of in a secure on almost like a base, or you're living in the embassy. But a lot of times you guys are living out in the country. I mean, you're living in homes or residences in the country. Is that right?
That's absolutely true. The vast majority of foreign service members do not live on a compound or a base of any kind. They live in houses or apartments similar to those which are occupied by, upper middle class people.
Sure.
In the country in which they are assigned.
And so with all of that, I mean, given the fact that you're not enclosed, that even puts you at a higher risk sometimes, depending on some of the countries that you're at.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the country to which I will be going shortly had a school attacked.
Mm-hmm.
The American International School was attacked. As I said, terrorists look for the soft spots.
Mm-hmm.
And that could be a school, that could be somebody's residence, that could be the supermarket to where people go shopping.
Mm-hmm.
Indeed, being out in the environment does have its own risks.
You know, with all of that, and as we look at that, because in these environments, and we kind of look at even pay, and I want to kind of talk about that, you guys are going into some very, very dangerous environments sometimes. Do you feel like the pay for Foreign Service officers when you go into these environments, do you feel like you guys are getting the just amount of pay? I mean, is it, you know, like sometimes in military, people get danger pay or other things like that. Are Foreign Service members getting what they fairly deserve when they go into certain environments?
Well, that's a complicated question because, in fact, I will say that nobody enters the Foreign Service with the intention of getting rich.
Right.
Simply put,
sure.
Many Foreign Service members could earn higher salaries outside the Foreign Service than they do in the Foreign Service. The number one motivator for service in the Foreign Service is patriotism and the desire to serve one's country.
Right.
That said, it's important to understand that by virtue of the fact that we work overseas, we don't have a lot of the same financial opportunities that many Americans have. For example, those of us who are married, it is very, very difficult in most cases to have a family in which both spouses work. Typically, there is no work for what we call the trailing spouse or the accompanying spouse. And therefore, you know, pretty much by definition, most Foreign Service families are a single income family.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We also don't frequently have the same kinds of opportunities to buy a house and pay off the mortgage the way many of our colleagues living in the U.S. do. Things like that affect the importance of our salaries.
Mm-hmm.
We also do not get something that 99.9% of all civilian government employees get, which is something called comparability pay or locality pay when we are overseas. We get it when we're in Washington, but we don't get it when we are overseas.
Well, why is that, though? I mean,
originally, when comparability pay was a matter of 3 or 4 percentage points, the Foreign Service was left out because it was assumed that we get things like, I won't say free housing, but we do not pay for the quarters that are leased for us or owned by the government.
Mm-hmm.
When we are overseas, things like that, when it was a matter of 3 or 4%, and when, incidentally, everybody had a defined benefit retirement plan, the comparability pay was considered something that was overshadowed by some of these perceived benefits that we got when we were working overseas. But now that comparability pay in Washington is almost 25%.
So really,
means
you could
that
be losing
overseas,
money.
You take a 25% decrease in salary. That has become important. Now, let me add that in the last 4 years, Congress approved something called overseas comparability pay, which is something that AFSA had fought for many years. And overseas comparability pay is currently in the process of being implemented for those of us who are serving overseas, and that will remedy the problem, but we're not 100% there yet.
Okay, so so we're looking at it passing. I mean, is that a guarantee that it's going to pass, or it's still got to come through some hoops and hurdles?
It still has to go through some hoops and hurdles because it has not been authorized by Congress in what's known as an authorization bill. So it is appropriated on an annual basis. For the State Department to pay, it's appropriated by Congress for the State Department on an annual basis, but it has not yet fully become part of what the State Department is authorized to do on an ongoing perpetual basis.
How is this? And we'll talk about this because we got to take a quick break. But I do want to know, how is this sequestration and how is this these budget battles, you know, really impacting you and impacting? I don't even maybe the morale, but impacting kind of State Department in terms of, you know, the resources and other things. Because your mission, you know, if you got people overseas, your mission just cannot stop. You just can't shut the embassy down and bring people home and everything else. I mean, you got a unique dynamic. You can't just furlough people and just have them stop their mission overseas. I want to know, how is this whole process right now of what we're dealing with these budget battles impacting you guys? We would take a quick break, Daniel. When we come back, we'll talk about this in a little bit more. We're talking to Daniel Hirsch. He's the vice president at American Foreign Service Association. He represents Department of State in the association, but the AFSA, which is American Foreign Service Association, they represent a number of member agencies, including State Department, USAID, the Broadcasting Board of Governors, USDA and their components, Foreign Commercial Service, and everything else. And so we're talking about the issues that deal with the Foreign Service, those who are Foreign Service officers and Foreign Service specialists. We'll keep on talking about this when we come back. Listen to Fed Access with Derek T. Dorch on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Welcome back to Fed Access with Derek T. Dorch on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. If you just joined us, we're talking about the Foreign Service. We're talking about the American Foreign Service Association, and we're talking about the issues that Foreign Service officers and Foreign Service specialists have to deal with in terms of going overseas and in terms of representing our country, but what issues that they have to face, security issues, pay issues, and everything else that's going on. We're talking to Daniel Hirsch. He represents the Department of State in the American Foreign Service Association. He's a vice president of that organization. Daniel, in this whole dynamic, you know, we got all this budget stuff and everybody, you know, in the next 8-9 days, whatever the case is, you know, hopefully we'll get past this thing in March. But truthfully, how is this budget crisis or this budget, the sequestration and everything else, what's been the impact on State Department?
Well, it's been a matter of very great concern, both to AFSA and to our members. The fact of the matter is, of course, the entire Foreign Service, like most federal employees, have had their salaries frozen for the last several years. Mm-hmm. So that has affected morale. That has affected our pocketbooks. And then the prospect of seeing sequestration and possibly accompanied by a furlough situation is a matter of grave concern. You are absolutely correct when you say that we cannot close down our embassies overseas, nor can we really reduce the product of our embassies overseas.
So what do you do? If there's a furlough situation, I mean, how is that handled, especially for an agency like yours?
Well, a number of things have been talked about, one of which is reducing the rate of hiring, not bringing on board some people that the agency wanted to bring on board this year. Another, of course, is delaying things like purchasing supplies, mm-hmm. Or paying for travel and training costs and things like that, all of which will have consequences down the road. But additionally, there is the prospect of furloughing employees, which means, of course, putting employees on administrative leave without pay for a period of time. And that means that people will not be able to do the work that they typically do. And
sure.
Let me stress here, one thing that many people don't realize is that not only, of course, does the work we do benefit the national security of the United States and lead to better relations with other countries, but also, importantly, we help create jobs and we help bring money into the American economy. When we issue visas to tourists or business people who are coming to the United States to either visit the United States or do business with the United States, that affects the economy.
Mm-hmm.
When we have our Foreign Commercial Service, for example, facilitating trade between American business people and foreign business people, that helps the American economy, that creates jobs. FCS has recently estimated that for every dollar that is paid into the salary of an FCS employee, $7 are added to the U.S. economy as a direct result of that one individual's work.
Okay.
So when we slow down, it has specific implications not only for national security but also for the American economy.
Wow. You know, with that and in the budget, now when the budget gets passed, are we expecting, I know you guys are probably monitoring, are we expecting an increases for, I mean, once we get past these budget battles, are we expecting any kind of increases? Or are we expecting what that State Department will receive?
Well, ideally, the simple fact of the matter is that the State Department has not for a number of years received all of the money that they asked for in any given year's budget. So ideally, what we would like to see is full funding of the budgets that are requested mm-hmm. by our agencies.
Right.
Those would include increases to security funding for sure. They also, in the case of the State Department at least, include some increases for increased hiring, keeping in mind that for many years, people have been saying that the State Department needed to hire more people, and also keeping in mind that under new programs we are expected to increase certain functions. For example, we are expected to dramatically increase the consular function over the next several years, and we need to hire people to do that.
You know, I mean, as you look at that, at the dynamic and say, hey, listen, we need to hire more people, we need to do certain things, how much do you think the State Department needs to increase? I mean, I know there's a number of different open billets that just can't be funded, but would you say, hey, listen, State Department needs a 1,000 more? I mean, are we talking about an increase in consulates across the world? Do we need more consulates? Do we need more embassies in places that we don't have full representation at? I mean, is that what we're looking at?
No, we're not looking at really at increasing any number of embassies, and we're not really significantly looking at increasing the number of consulates, although we are looking at increasing our consular presence in certain key countries
okay.
like Brazil, China, and Russia, and India, for example, where they have rapidly growing economies and
sure.
where they have people who really want to do business with the United States. But we are looking at, as I said, for example, bringing our overseas office buildings into up to the Inman standards, up to the standards that were proposed by the Inman Commission. We are looking at hiring up to the levels where we will not have what we call the mid-level staffing gap, where right now we have a dearth of employees at certain levels in certain skill groups. There we are looking not at huge numbers. I don't have the numbers in front
sure,
of me.
Sure, sure, sure.
But we're talking probably on the order of, an extra 500 or 1,000 people a year over a couple of year period.
Right, to really fulfill the mission.
Right.
Right. You know, with all of that, as we begin and you know, you've had the unique perspective to kind of be overseas and kind of talk to people and kind of see what the perception is of the United States. You know, a lot of things changed after 9/11. There's been a number of different dynamics. What do you see the future of foreign relations? As we kind of close out today, what do you see the future of foreign relations is? I mean, are you hopeful or do you feel like people have a really negative impression of the U.S.? I mean, where do you see we going?
Well, the United States is a world leader in many, many ways and is still one of the most respected countries in the world. The fact that a relatively small number of people with significant reach have, you know, managed to attack us on occasion does not change the fact that for a majority of the people in the world, we are very respected and emulated and viewed as a strong friend and a strong ally. I mean, the future of international relations is always good. It's always something that we absolutely need, both to protect our national security and to help us and our business people and our citizens relate to people all over the world. I think that as other countries develop and as they become more democratic and as their levels of education and health and so on improve. We will be seeing an increase in the number of allies that the United States has, and in the number of strategic both military and business partners that we have. And relationships have to be maintained. I mean, it's not just a question, of course, of, you know, developing a good relationship now and then forgetting about it. It's a question of constantly maintaining good relations with all of the people with whom we treat in a world that is becoming ever smaller and smaller in many ways.
And with all of that, I mean, that's where State Department, Foreign Commercial Service, USAID, and the other other agencies, that's where you guys are the ones who are maintaining these relationships. And oftentimes in places, because I've seen that you guys have increased the amount of stability operation work you're doing to focusing on Africa and other places that are unstable. You know, as we see, hopefully those countries get more stable, we'll need you guys even more, it seems.
Oh, absolutely. And of course, the before they become more stable, they have to be helped to become more stable. But basically, when we are successful in promoting democracy, when we are successful in helping people improve their health and their nutrition and their educational prospects and the ways they manage their resources and so on, we are helping them reach a state at which they are more stable. They are less likely to wage war with themselves or others, and all of that is important. The other thing we have seen, of course, is that, for example, if you look at the so-called Arab Spring, events can change very fast in the world, and countries can change their internal politics and their internal situations very quickly and occasionally in unexpected ways. And you need to be able to have the United States government interact with those parties and have the United States government alter its relationships if necessary, you know, to meet any kinds of changes that occur.
I think that was well said, Daniel. We've run out of time, unfortunately. I'm going to have to definitely have you back, you know, before you probably get out of here and go to the next country and serve our country well. Thank you guys for your service. Thank you for everything you do. Hopefully these issues will continue to be heard by the leadership of our country, the leadership of State Department and everything else, and whether it be the pay issues or fairness and everything else that needs to be brought to the table to make sure that you guys can do the job effectively. Thank you for coming on Fed Access.
Thank you, Derek.
You've been listening to Fed Access with Derek T. Dorch on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear it in its entirety on our website, federalnewsradio.com. Fed Access with Derek T. Dorch, Friday afternoons at noon, only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM, WFED, your source for federal news now.